Here it is!
From deep inside your radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, what a lovely welcome back to the Le Show Dome from an anonymous university police person. And you thank you, sir. I'm in possession of a story from the Times of London, whence I recently returned. I didn't return from the Times, I returned from London, as you know, if you're a constant listener of this broadcast. And if not, why not? And it's really one of those stories that you don't want to read past the headline. Because the headline is, Houdini's grave to be opened, but what will they find there? And I don't know what the story says, but I know what the answer is, Geraldo Rivera. On the other hand, there's a story from Friday's Washington Post regarding the United States' involvement with Mexico's war on drugs and drug smuggling gangs. Did you hear this? The United States has contributed zilch, that's a quote, to Mexico's efforts to combat the nation's joint problem with narcotics gangs. That's according to Mexico's new ambassador to Washington. We're going to need significantly more cooperation from the United States, Ambassador Arturo Sarukhan, interesting name, said, including increased aid and intelligence. You want our intelligence, babe? You can have it. Oh, and stepped up U.S. efforts to stop the southward flow of weapons, laundered money, and chemicals for the production of amphetamines. His comments came in an interview with Washington Post editors and reporters, echoing recent criticism by the president of Mexico. President Calderon has asserted since his inauguration that the United States is not doing enough to lower U.S. drug consumption to help Mexico combat traffickers. But the ambassador says the United States is doing zilch. Would it be they have double negatives in Spanish, so isn't doing zilch probably would be the proper way of translating it. Ladies and gentlemen, because there can never be enough public radio, non-commercial station WNYC New York is partnering with Public Radio International, the BBC World Service, the New York Times Radio, and WGBH Boston. You got enough partners? Okay. To produce a new national public radio morning show to compete with NPR's Morning Edition. Don't you know? New York Times reports the show is expected to include reports from Times and BBC staffers and will be more informal and conversational than Morning Edition. That's right. Your criticisms are right on the money. It's not conversational enough. But no, wait, there's more. There's more about what you need in a morning program on public radio to tell you about the world. NPR itself plans a new similar morning program co-hosted by Luke Burbank. It will be a younger alternative to Morning Edition. That's right. Morning Edition is too old, you see, ladies and gentlemen. But in a more substantive comment on NPR, this week, I searched NPR's website just to double-check my own impression that there'd been nothing on this story this week on NPR's two flagship news programs. And according to NPR's own search engine, it came up empty for searches on the subject of the Army Corps of Engineers. Why would I be searching for that? This from the New Orleans Times-Picayune this week, ladies and gentlemen. Decades of incompetence and neglect by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers allowed Hurricane Katrina's storm surge to devastate New Orleans. That's according to the long-awaited report issued this week by Team Louisiana, the state of Louisiana's official investigation into the causes of the disaster. Why would that make news on NPR or anywhere else? In a sweeping indictment of Corps stewardship, the report alleges agency supervisors ignored increases in the threat level for their project being to protect New Orleans from hurricanes, knowingly built levees and flood walls lower than was mandated by Congress, failed to detect or ignored glaring errors during the review process, underestimated the impact of the canal they built, the Mississippi River Gulf Outlet, on the city's flood defenses, and failed to properly maintain the system. Aside from that, Mrs. Lincoln, they're doing a wonderful job. The report echoes many points made in other probes last year, including that of the UC Berkeley's independent investigation. Those efforts focused largely on the technical aspects of the structural failures, but the LSU-based Team Louisiana report pinpointed the decisions that caused those failures. Quote, it's one thing to use modern state-of-the-art computer technology to determine what happened, and the other teams did a very good job of that, said Ivar van Heerden. You may remember him from having been interviewed on this broadcast last year. He continues, but the only way to really understand if mistakes were made was by relying entirely on using the tools the Corps would have used or should have used back when they did their designs. The 10-member investigative team spent almost 18 months and $200,000 on the effort. Key findings, by ignoring two increases in the severity of the Standard Project Hurricane, the model storm the system was designed to thwart, the Corps knowingly failed its mandate from Congress in 1965 to protect the city of New Orleans against, quote, the most severe combination of meteorological conditions reasonably expected, unquote. The original model was based on research through 1959. The Corps did nothing to strengthen the system in response to two increases in the projected strength of the model storm in 72 and 79. Says Van Heerden, our research shows very clearly the standard was changed, but the Corps just kept going about its business as if nothing happened. Katrina, a Category 3 storm when it made landfall, fell far short of the expectation of the most severe hurricane, according to what the Corps already knew. In 1985, the head of the project that the Corps was building to protect New Orleans from hurricanes, ordered his staff to ignore an official reduction in the elevation of the land they were building on, to take into account subsidence of the land, which meant the Corps finished levees and flood walls it knew were as much as 2 feet lower than claimed. Had the walls been built as high as we called for, as was called for, the flood walls would have been overtopped in the lower Ninth Ward for a maximum of an hour and a half rather than 4.5 hours. The extra 3 hours, according to Van Heerden, resulted in deep damage on the protected side of the flood walls, contributing to the catastrophic collapse that sent a wall of water roaring through the neighborhood, killing more than 100 people. Below design walls and levees contributed to many of the more than 50 breaches the system suffered during Katrina, according to the Team Louisiana study. Applying the Corps' own design manuals in use at the time, Team Louisiana found instances where the agency missed glaring engineering mistakes made by subcontractors, which led to breaches, including those on the 17th Street and London Avenue canals. The Corps failed in its responsibility to properly maintain the parts of the system, including keeping pace with subsidence. The agency ignored advances in engineering and knowledge and technology that could have prevented the flood. The system was managed, quote, like a circa 1965 flood control museum, unquote, according to the report. The Corps made no improvements to account for well-known changes in elevations, sea level rise, or even gaps left in the system. Paul Kemp, part of Team Louisiana, said he was, quote, struck by the fact the Corps showed no sense of mission on the project, even though it was involved with it for more than 40 years. Why would that be news on NPR? Hello, welcome to the show. Please give. I'm sure they'll report it when they're younger.
Oh, pick your feet up. You can feel the heat rise from the ground. It's in your blood now, it's in your bones. Let it flow, let it flow, let it flow. Ooh, something simple, something sweet. About the way you shake your hips and move your feet, yeah. Breathing deep now to your soul.
about the way you shake your head to move your feet. Shake. Breathing in arms through your soul. Let it flow, let it flow, let it flow.
From the edge of America, from the home of the homeless, I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this edition of the show. And now, we haven't done this for a while, Tales of Airport Security. It's still a copyrighted feature after all this time. Couple tales this week. One from a listener, one from yours truly. Dear Harry, writes Brandon, you might be pleased to know that I'm 22 years old, but I'm a frequent listener of the show. And that's even before we get the younger version rolled out, Brandon. Thank you. I thought I would send a tale. He says, a few months ago, I was flying from Chicago midway to Logan in Boston. I'd only been in Chicago for a three-day weekend, although it's my hometown. When I was returning to Boston, I'd gone through the security checkpoint with no problems at Midway. While I was waiting for my flight, I decided to look for my headphones in my backpack. When I got to the bottom of my backpack, I saw and remembered that I had a box of 100 razor blades. My jaw dropped at the sight of the box, but I realized I couldn't show any sort of signs that something was wrong. So I attempted to act as I normally would. I happened to make it back to Boston with no problems at all. I couldn't believe that I'd made it through security with a box of 100 razor blades. I'm a bassoonist and need the razor blades to make reeds. From Brandon, this from me. I was violating my own personal pledge never to fly out of London's Heathrow Airport ever again in my life. Yeah, that qualifies me for political office now that I've violated a pledge. Literally, when was it? Well, literally less than a week ago. Tuesday. And I don't know about you, ladies and gentlemen, but everywhere I've flown in the last little while, I've been allowed to fly with a carry-on bag and a little computer bag. You can have a carry-on and a personal item, and your purse or your computer bag is regarded as a personal item. So I checked my two pieces of checked baggage, walked up to the security point, at which time I was informed by the lady, one bag only. Excuse me? One bag only. An 11-hour flight coming up. I've got food, I've got reading material, a couple DVDs to watch, some stuff, as I say, to read. That's in my carry-on bag, my computers in my computer bag. Am I going to get either of them to the airline to check in at this point? What do you think? Finally, she comes over to me and says, here's what I recommend. Take your computer out of your computer bag, carry it in your arms, and she shows me the holding baby in arms posture. Pack your computer bag if you can get it into your other bag. Then you've got one bag. So that's what I do. And then I get into the, quote, fast track line. That takes 15 minutes to get to security. That's the fast track. And I'm grateful. I get to security. I get to the x-ray machine. I put my one bulging, pretty hard to zip closed bag through the x-ray machine, noting with some satisfaction or relief that at least they don't make you take off your shoes. I get to the other side of the x-ray machine and the security woman there says, sir, is this your bag? I say, yeah. We're going to have to break it down. What do you mean? Well, you have a bag inside a bag. So they open the computer bag, take that out, take everything. Basically, they undo everything I've just done. And for my efforts, I get to spend another 10 minutes while they run all those bags through again. Oh, P.S., when I finish with all that, start walking towards my gate, I realize there's one new additional extra checkpoint they've put in since the last time I was there. About 100 yards down the line from where the main security checkpoint is, a special new checkpoint just for your shoes. Tales of Airport Security, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Yeah, the magic, the glamour, the romance of jet travel. But we all feel safer, don't we? Ladies and gentlemen, news of the digital wonderland. Television manufacturer LG has released a software upgrade to fix a glitch in some of its televisions, which causes them to freeze when watching a specific channel in Australia. Don't know if that happens here. Digital television watchers, particularly in Melbourne and Sydney, have been plagued by the problem for up to 3 weeks. LG is working with the networks to ensure that no further disruptions are experienced by viewers, but the cause was a software issue. Selected TVs intermittently lock up or freeze under certain signal transmissions. LG advises in the unlikely event prior to the software upgrade that a customer experiences a further TV freeze, they advise to simply turn the power off, unplug the TV, leave it off for 20 minutes, and allow the unit to completely power down. Reboot your TV, in other words, but turn it off and unplug it first. I guess they're suggesting to plug it back in afterwards, but, you know, you could just leave it in that unplugged state, and you'd be a happier person. Now, also on the subject of the digital wonderland, customers are still grappling with digital transitions in television, but there's, of course, that other digital turn in the road ahead, HD radio. How do I sound today? The number of U.S. stations airing HD radio, so-called HD radio, tops 1,000. Consumers who are willing to pay more to buy an HD radio, supposedly more programs are available. I think this program is available on a couple of side channels in Seattle and New Orleans. Reason enough, ladies and gentlemen. But while people are starting to hear of HD radio, this is from a San Diego newspaper. Thanks to an aggressive marketing campaign, few have actually heard it. What's the point of this article, you might ask? Well, it's pretty good. Okay. I guess we'll point with pride to HD radio, ladies and gentlemen, as one of the few triumphs in the digital wonderland straight ahead. How are things going in Iraq? Let's ask the Inspector General. The Inspector General for Iraqi Reconstruction. According to his latest report, the U.S. government was unprepared for the extensive nation-building required after it invaded Iraq. At each juncture where it could have adjusted its efforts, it failed even to understand the problems it faced. This according to the IG's latest report. Stuart W. Bowen said in the days after the invasion, the Defense Department had no strategy for restoring either government institutions or infrastructure, and in the years since, other agencies joined the effort without an overall plan and without a structure in place to organize and execute a task of such magnitude. It must be the grown-ups in charge. That's what it sounds like to me. That's grown-up behavior. Lines of authority remained unclear in the reconstruction effort, with a demand for speed and a shortage of government personnel. Much of the oversight was turned over to the contractors doing the work. The oversight was turned over to the people doing the work. That's a good system. That will ensure that no money is wasted. There was little coordination among the various agencies. The result was a series of missed opportunities to address the unraveling situation. Many layers of management, said Bowen, made it difficult to determine who had ultimate authority over money, people, and projects. The war report makes 9 recommendations. That'll help. Now. Recommendations include improving contracting and procurement guidelines involving people who were familiar with the region. That's a good recommendation. Let's do that. Let's involve people who are familiar with the region when we invade the region. Shall we? Good recommendation, Stu. I never thought of that. Hiring local contractors and vendors is also recommended. Better planning of short and long-term reconstruction programs. Yes, better planning, please. And establishing guidelines on the length of tours for those working on reconstruction projects. The report for the first time lays out a timeline documenting the paucity of planning from the beginning of the war in Iraq, noting what was needed when, and describing how the scale of reconstruction grew. It details how Congress provided vast amounts of money with little idea of how it was being spent. Isn't that what Congress normally does? The lack of coordination magnified every shortcoming. Bowen said changes like those that took place in Iraq are not short-term affairs. They're complicated with social, political, and security dimensions, and if you can't think of all the pieces of them together, then you're not ever going to end up with a response that works. But what a radical new idea to involve people who are familiar about a region in mucking about in the region. Security, of course, was a problem. There were no suggestions early on that civilian workers would be unsafe in Iraq. One project experienced 3 evacuations, a hijacking incident, and the ransacking of 2 offices. Looting, sabotage, and attacks on people occurred at some of the infrastructure contractors' construction sites. Initial post-invasion plans were off the mark. There were assumptions that the Iraqi infrastructure was in reasonably good shape. The Iraqi government would be able to pick up and sustain itself rapidly, and that Iraqi oil and gas production would help provide revenue to fuel the economy, all of which proved unfounded. It was funded. It was unfounded. Some of that good intel or just best-case scenarios. Plan A, ladies and gentlemen. When you got a plan A, you don't need a plan B, isn't that? And with those conclusions ringing in our ears, the Bush administration tries to get rid of yet another inspector general. The Environmental Protection Agency's Office of Inspector General is preparing for significant staff reductions in 2008, thanks to budget cuts authorized by the White House. The new proposal will be cutting the inspector general's budget by 10%. Critics charge the office as being attacked because it has issued several reports during the administration that have been highly critical of the EPA's regulatory enforcement and its alleged tendency to bow to political and industry pressure. Don't you know? I guess you do. I guess you do now. And now, the apologies of the week. Senator Chris Dodd is almost sorry. He said during a trip to Iowa that he regrets voting for the war. I wish I could have the vote back, he says. I made a mistake. Hasn't quite said he's sorry, but he regrets it. As her tumultuous reign comes to an end, Miss USA Tara Conner says she's sorry. In an interview with Matt Lauer on the Today program, she said she met with 51 young women currently competing for her crown and told them how sorry she is for what she's done. I apologize to all of them for everything they had to go through. It was something everyone had to deal with, she said, referring to revelations in December that she'd been drinking and doing drugs. Her reign has now ended. Hey, reign has ended. Should be sunny. Dateline Williamsburg. I don't know where Williamsburg is, so I'm not going to read that one. Rush Limbaugh is sorry for suggesting that Governor Schwarzenegger's turn away from Republican conservative principles is based on Maria Shriver, his wife. Limbaugh said in his broadcast this week after a long interview with Schwarzenegger, I'm not sure Maria gets a word in edgewise in their house. I may have to revise my thought process on that. I am sorry. I apologize to all of you and to our affiliate stations for this. To apologize to Governor Schwarzenegger for something I've implied. His turn to left was because of Maria. A TV host has apologized. Jim Cramer of CNBC has apologized for saying he and other hedge fund managers can easily manipulate security prices for quick gains. In a call to the syndicated radio show Emis in the morning, Cramer said he should have been more clear when he spoke about how fun and lucrative it is to manipulate stocks. That's right. It was lacking in clarity. In a Wall Street Confidential video clip posted last December, Cramer said stock manipulation is easy because, quote, the SEC, Securities and Exchange Commission, doesn't get it. Cramer said in the video he used some of the tactics himself, including lying to reporters to get them to report misinformation on particular stocks. Yeah, that sounds unclear to me. I have no idea what he means. Deadline Washington, a single confident source close to John Edwards told me, this is from the Politico website, blogger Ben Smith told me this morning that Edwards was suspending his campaign, and I posted it to the blog. My source and I were wrong. My apologies to our readers for passing on bad information. Former Deputy Interior Secretary J. Stephen Griles has pleaded guilty to one felony count of obstruction of justice for lying to a Senate committee about his ties to jailed lobbyist Jack Abramoff. Griles apologized for misleading the Senate Indian Affairs Subcommittee about the nature of his relationship with Abramoff. He then told investigators that Abramoff was no different than any other lobbyist when, in fact, Abramoff had direct access to Griles. I'm sorry for my wrongdoing. I fully accept the responsibility for my conduct and the consequences it may have. The Justice Department's Inspector General, there goes another one, says to a committee of angry House members that the FBI may have violated the law or government policies as many as 3,000 times since 2003 as agents secretly collected telephone, bank, and credit records of U.S. citizens and foreign nationals residing here. The FBI's general counsel, Valerie Caproni, attributed the shortcomings to poor controls and offered profuse apologies. I think the public should be concerned. We're concerned, and we're going to fix it, she said. She attributed the F report card from the Inspector General partly to the Bureau's inexperience in conducting its national security work in secrecy away from a judicial system that threatens to expose any flaws. Quote, that imposes upon us a far higher obligation to make sure we have a rigorous compliance system. In other words, having to have a higher standard is the reason why they had a lower standard. She noted that the FBI never told its agents to retain signed copies of the national security letters. This was an example of the incredibly sloppy practice that was unacceptable, said the Inspector General. She said, we're sorry. China's Beijing Weather Bureau has apologized to the public for being wrong in forecasting temperatures for 3 days running. Forecasters promised to do better for the Olympics of next year. Kanan Makia, an Iraqi exile under Saddam Hussein and a key intellectual inspiration for the U.S. policy of regime change, has admitted he failed to foresee the consequences for the country of the invasion. In an interview in the New York Times, Makia, author of Republic of Fear, the book that brought the brutality of Hussein's regime to international attention, concedes he allowed his own activism to sway his judgment and then launched a scathing denunciation of U.S. policy after the fall of Baghdad. "It was a disaster, an unmitigated disaster," Makia said. "I was just so upset, even on the verge of tears. It was the antithesis of everything I'd been working for. Just like everything about the war, it was an opportunity wasted." He says his disaffection with the Iraq project has been growing for some time. "It's not like I didn't think about this," he added, "but nonetheless, I allowed myself as an activist to put all this aside in the hope it could be worked through. That did not work out, and he is regretful." This I have to read, I guess, in the voice of the author.
"The readership gave me a good whack upside the head over last week's column. Hundreds of them, in fact. The column was meant to be witty. But two sentences about gay people aroused some readers to a high pitch of indignation. You shouldn't write a column if you're afraid to be compared to weasels. Sociopaths and culture. Vlad the Inhaler. Impaler, sorry.
Vlad the Inhaler is a good name for a product, though, Garrison.
All right, then."
Garrison continues to write, quote, "I live in a small world, the world of entertainment, musicians, writers, in which gayness is as common as having brown eyes. But in the larger world, gayness is controversial. In the small world I live in, they are accepted and cherished as individuals. My column spoke as we would speak in my small world, and it was read by people in the larger world, and thus the misunderstanding. For that, I am sorry. Gay people who set out to be parents can be just as good parents as anybody else, and they know that, and so do I. A man stood outside the theater where I did a show Saturday night and handed out angry pamphlets calling on the audience to protest my homophobia. A gay writer friend was with me at the show. I asked him what I had done wrong, and he said, quote, 'You mentioned us.' I looked at him quizzically. He said, quote,
'I'll handle gay parenting, and you stick to the Norwegians,' unquote. It's a deal."
Garrison Keillor apologizing, ladies and gentlemen. And Andres Martinez is sorry because he asked Brian Grazer, film producer, to guest edit the op-ed section of today's Los Angeles Dog Trainer. Not that, as has been pointed out by Mickey Kaus, not that the Los Angeles Times is short of guest editors. They've had hundreds over the last few years. But Martinez is sorry because he was having a romantic liaison with a woman who worked for the publicity firm that handles Brian Grazer. So Martinez has resigned, is sorry, and is angry all at once. And finally, producer Dallas Austin, so nice he named himself after two Texas cities, has apologized to Christina Aguilera and Joss Stone after claiming they offered to perform sexual favors in exchange for his work on their albums. That's an apology you can take to the bank, ladies and gentlemen. The Apologies of the Week, copyrighted feature. Oh, by the way, the bank is closed today. Copyrighted feature of this broadcast.
So long.
This is Le Show, and ladies and gentlemen, adding his voice to those who were critical of the U.S. base at Guantanamo, the U.S. base for detainees at Guantanamo Bay, the New York Times reported on Friday, Robert Gates, the new defense secretary, in his first weeks in the office, repeatedly argued that the facility had become so tainted abroad, the legal proceedings at Guantanamo would be viewed as illegitimate. He told President Bush and others that it should be shut down as quickly as possible. His suggestion was rejected, ultimately by President Bush, initially by embattled Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez. And the position of Gonzalez was backed, according to the New York Times, backed by the office of Vice President Dick Cheney, according to administration officials. Yes, an office backed a position. Sounds vaguely like no humans were involved. In his arguing for the closing of Guantanamo, Gates got support from Condoleezza Rice. And also this week, Vice President Cheney went into the hospital. The blood clot that was found in his leg when he returned from his trip to Pakistan was acting up. He was experiencing pain in his leg. He went to the hospital for some tests and reportedly is just fine and still below ground.
Next, intimate tales of America's first underground vice president. The action-packed diary of a man who's just a heartbeat away from history. Dick Cheney. Confidential. The week began with a flare-up of pain from the blood clot in my leg. And it went downhill from there. Oh, there was nothing particularly troublesome medically about the clot. The primary doctor on my heart account says it was caused by that recent long flight I had back from Pakistan. And frankly, a little clot in my leg was nothing compared to the dent I left in President Musharraf's windpipe. No, the problem occasioned by the clot had more to do with a certain itchiness of finger the episode seemingly engendered in my constituent in chief. So, while I was in the hospital getting tests to make sure my blood was being properly thinned, I was on the phone with El so-called Jefe, trying to keep him from imagining life with the leash off. Tuesday, 2:17 p.m.
So, just don't want you being a hero, you know, getting back to work before the doc says it's okay.
Mm-hmm. Mr. President, if I was going to take orders from a cardiologist, I think that might endanger our entire project of reinvigorating the power framework of the executive branch. Frankly, sir,
yeah,
I'd take orders from you sooner than I'd take orders from a doctor.
Well, that's not going to happen. Heck, Dick, you haven't steered me wrong ever since you found that the best qualified man for your job was you.
Mm-hmm.
Just hate to think what might happen if, you know, your blood got too thin or too fat or however it could go haywire if you rushed your recovery and I'd have to go through the rest of my last 2 years without your firm hand on my tiller.
George, if you want me to use this clot episode as a pretext for stepping aside, if you think that my continued presence in the administration represents a political liability for our little agenda of robustness, you know all you have to do is indicate your feelings in writing, and I'll have the doc here err on the side of caution.
Oh. No need for that, Dixter.
And Lynn and I will just move out of the secure undisclosed, and I'll retreat to a life of seclusion and targeted leaking.
Well, there's really no need for that, buddy.
Mr. President, maybe I just have a slightly sunnier take about human nature. But I don't think our friends in the Pelosi-whipped party would seek to extract partisan advantage from anything I could disclose about decisions and personnel practices taken during the first term of this administration.
Well, I know you have that half glass full attitude, train gang. I'm just saying that, you know, maybe a few weeks of rest.
And what I'm saying is, why not cut the cord? Whatever strength of character and devotion to principle I brought to this office is long since osmosed into folks like, I don't know, someone over there.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think both Bob Novak and I would like nothing better than to just hang out and reminisce. He'd do the hanging.
Yeah.
I'd do the reminiscing. You know, some cute intel stories I still get a kick out of.
Yeah.
He might get a kick out of them, too. A big kick.
You know something, Dick? Heck, I'm no cardiographer, but you're sounding mighty healthy to me. I don't know what that ulterior sound deal is telling your doctor about your heart, but boy, it's coming across good and strong at this end. So why don't you...
Here's what I'm hearing you saying, sir. Why don't I resume my regular schedule as soon as possible?
Think you're reading my mind there, Dixter.
Yeah, well, a little light reading never hurt anybody, sir.
Okay, you tell that doctor he didn't get you back to work in 30 minutes. He's going to have to answer to you.
Mm-hmm.
I'll see you in the morning.
You got that right, Mr. President. Unfortunately, not everybody in the government gets the message as quickly and as profoundly as the constituent in chief does. Some folks think we're running a debating society here and that you get points for persistence. Some people this week needed to learn otherwise. A certain new Secretary of Defense needed some assistance in figuring out that a unitarily powerful executive branch doesn't necessarily mean him. Thursday, 11:17 a.m.
Glad you could make the time to see me, Mr. Vice President. I know how close you were with my predecessor, and I...
Mr. Gates,
yeah.
The fact that you won't be one-tenth the Defense Secretary Don Rumsfeld was doesn't mean I can't extend some secure and disclosed hospitality to you.
Well...
I understand you have a bone in your throat about Guantanamo.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly what is it about a walk in the dark side you don't understand?
Dick, look, you may be right about the best way to extract intelligence from the few high-value detainees we still have at Gitmo, but in the meantime, the black eye it's giving our country is making it much harder to get much more useful intelligence from many more people who just don't want to work with us. It's like we erected a reverse Statue of Liberty.
Bob, let's not pretend either of us gives a crap about who gets what intel from whom.
Well,
I know the game you're playing. You're grandstanding for the Pelosi-crats. You take a nice Pelosi-pleasing public stance against Gitmo, and the appropriations chairman let a few more billions stay in the Pentagon budget. I've been there. I've played that game. But now, Bob, I'm not playing.
Well, none of us are playing, Dick.
Some of us are playing less than others, my friend.
Yeah.
You know, you're not the first cabinet secretary to pay me a visit on this particular subject today.
No? You mean...
Condi Rice had an appointment about an hour before you. Very persuasive on the reverse Statue of Liberty talking point. Almost had me crying in my blood thinner.
Secretary Rice was here?
Is here.
But I don't see...
We were debating the finer points of enhanced interrogation techniques. I offered to demonstrate one of them.
You're not...
She strapped onto the Pilates machine.
Oh. You know, for a moment there, I thought you were...
With the tension turned way too high.
Mr. Vice President, this isn't the kind of behavior that can stand in a...
In a unitary executive? No, you're right, Mr. Secretary. You should call up Bob Novak or somebody. Of course, you haven't seen anything. It's not really that believable. And your only source is me. And I'm not really that believable. So be my guest.
I think maybe you're underestimating me, Dick. I don't play the call-up Bob Novak game. I play the inside game. People who knew me at the agency thought I played it pretty well.
Bob, I think you're right. I think you should ignore the clear signals about how these decisions are made around here and go straight above the top to the president. I think he'd like to be alerted that the guy who let him fire Rummy has, quote, gone too far. Think he'd be interested in that piece of intel from the guy whose former agency still can't find Bin Laden. Doors open.
Well, I think maybe I should wait for Secretary Rice.
Suit yourself. She still owes me 100 more reps. Think I'm going to like Bob Gates as soon as he absorbs the meaning of the word cabinet. Last time I looked, it's a place where you put away the stuff you're not using anymore. End of partial diary for the end of March 2007. Sincerely yours, Dick Cheney. Confidential.
Just good fun. Would rather be a thin man. I am so glad to go on being one. Too much to carry around with you. No chance of finding a woman who will love you in the morning. To ignore all that, hate to admit to myself, half of my problems came from being fat. Won't waste my time feeling sorry for him. I see the other side through being thin. Rollers both down a mountain and I'm sure the fat man would win.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, news of the warm, won't you?
Soft, listen to the warm. We can listen to the warm.
This year, according to ABC News, there's a growing realization that global warming is beginning to take a toll on Vermont's signature product, maple syrup. The industry may be forced to move north to Canada. Hello, Canada. Meanwhile, another report, melting Arctic sea ice may have reached a tipping point, triggering global climate change, according to a new University of Colorado study. The climate change could reach into Earth's temperate regions. Scientists have postulated for years that dwindling sea ice in both the Arctic and Antarctic regions caused by higher greenhouse gases is leading to a negative feedback loop, leading to increased global warming. Melting sea ice does not increase sea levels. It decreases the salinity of oceans and creates a greater surface area of ocean that absorbs rather than reflects the sun's radiation, both of which serve to reinforce the trend towards global warming, setting up what you might call, what you should call, a feedback loop. And that's what we may be facing. News of the warm, ladies and gentlemen, but now... now there's something else.
Harriet.
It's not that either. It's this. News from outside the bubble. We'll figure it out. Or we'll be towed. One of the two. This from The Age in Australia. But thanks, Dick, for calling my name. A team of senior military officers that has recently returned from Afghanistan is preparing a report for the Australian government saying the tide is turning against the Western allies in the south of Afghanistan. Security is collapsing there, and support for the Taliban is growing. Aside from that, Mrs. Lincoln, it's fine. The report is based on a survey of 17,000 Afghans, warning security in the south of the country is on a knife edge, with growing support for the Taliban, widespread pessimism about the chances of defeating the guerrillas, and growing disenchantment with the coalition effort. The survey was carried out earlier this month by a European-based international policy think tank. It details a dramatic deterioration in stability in the south of Afghanistan. The result is a clear indication the tide is turning in that area, says the think tank. The results of the survey are extremely alarming because they indicate the international community is in serious trouble in Afghanistan, it says. News from outside the bubble and merging into the buried lead department. The Times of London reports that scientists warn of cannabis time bomb. By the end of the decade, one in four new cases of schizophrenia could be triggered by smoking marijuana, scientists say. That's at the top of the story. At the end of the story, cannabis resin has changed little. The new supposedly more powerful marijuana, called skunk in Britain, makes it 2 to 3 times more powerful, not, as papers including the Times of London have reported, 20 to 30 times more powerful. But, of course, that's at the end of the story. News from outside the bubble. Copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Ladies and gentlemen, that's going to conclude this week's edition of the show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations over NPR worldwide throughout Europe, on the USEN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet. Shortwave radio, think of it. Around the world via the internet, going into a different century of technology, at 2 different locations, live and archived on your computer whenever you want at harryshearer.com and kcrw.com. Available on the mighty 104 in Berlin, on both Sirius and XM satellite radios. Available as a free download at www.audible.com/leshow and available as a free podcast at kcrw.com. And it would be just like being welcomed back to the home of the homeless if you'd agree to join with me then. Would you already? Thank you very much. Oh, by the way, one more apology. The mayor of London has formally apologized for London's role in the slave trade. Thought you'd like to know that. Makes everybody happy. Especially the protesters have gone to London to ask that Tony Blair apologize. You never know. He might apologize. Be a good farewell address, don't you think? Goodbye, and I'm sorry for slavery. Good night, everyone. Ladies and gentlemen, the email address for this program is lemail, L-E-M-A-I-L, at interworld.net. Le Show Internet Services by Steve Mack, a tip of the Le Show chapeau to the Pittsburgh and San Diego desks. The show playlist available at harryshearer.com. We're going to be working on a younger version of this broadcast for next week. Please join us. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless. Now we'll just break down your bags and you'll be free to go.